lobbying his colleagues to join the opinion. For an issue as profound and divisive as school segregation, Warren recognized that the court would be much stronger if it spoke with a single voice. When the court finally handed down its decision in Brown in 1954, the opinion was unanimous. It was surprisingly light, however, on legal analysis. The opinion, written by Chief Justice Warren, opened by explaining that the history of the 14th Amendment is inconclusive on the question of whether equal protection permits segregation in public schools. Some of the amendment's strongest supporters wanted to remove all legal distinctions among persons born in the United States. Opponents of the 14th Amendment wanted it construed as narrowly as possible. And of course, there were a range of views in between these extremes. Complicating the analysis still further, in the 1860s, there wasn't much tradition of public education, so past practices provided little guidance. Instead of relying on history, then, the court turned instead to the effects of segregation on public education. Education, it found, is perhaps the most important function of state and local government. It is the foundation of citizenship, and school segregation has terrible consequences for African American children. To separate black children from white children solely because of their race, the court explained, generates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. This detrimental effect is all the greater because it has the sanction of law. In support of this analysis, the court relied on psychological research on the effects of racism on the development of children. Finding evidence that segregation results in a harmful stigma with long-lasting detrimental effects, the court held that separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. It therefore concluded that Plessy's rule of separate but equal could no longer stand. Brown is unquestionably one of the most morally important decisions in the Supreme Court's history. However, because the opinion is focused more on the harmful effects of segregation than on an analysis of what equal protection of the laws entail, it's hard to know precisely what view of equal protection Brown stands for. For example, the decision could be read as embracing an anti-subordination principle, that is, a rule that the Constitution forbids state practices that treat certain people as second-class citizens. Alternatively, Brown could be read as embracing colorblindness, that is, a rule that the state may not make distinctions on the basis of racial differences. Both theories of equal protection would require invalidation of school segregation. But as we will see in the future, they have different implications for other issues, such as affirmative action. You may be wondering why the court said so little in such an important case. The most likely explanation is that the contents of Chief Justice Warren's opinion were about all the nine justices could agree on, and Warren did not want to risk saying more for fear of fracturing the court's unanimity. The decision also avoided language strongly condemning the terrible injustice of segregation. Probably Warren and the other justices were concerned that many whites in the South would respond to the decision with hostility and hope that a softer touch might produce compliance. Another curious aspect of Brown is that the court's opinion specified no remedy. It did not explain how or when jurisdiction should fix the constitutional problem. This was undoubtedly because the justices themselves were divided, not just on why segregation was unconstitutional, but also on what to do about it. Some thought that segregation had to be ended immediately. Others felt that an immediate order would go beyond the court's authority and would result in chaos that would highlight the court's weakness. The court therefore punted on this problem in Brown itself, but in the next year, 1955, the issue returned to them in a case that has since been known as Brown v. Board of Education II. Still unsure quite how to tackle the problem, the justices ended up ordering the lower court to fashion remedies with all deliberate speed. What does all deliberate speed mean? The phrase seems internally contradictory, requiring haste, but also care and deliberation. It seems to reflect the justices' recognition that whether they required Southern schools to desegregate immediately or at their own pace, the court would look impotent if its order were disobeyed. Instead, it issued an order vague enough that nobody quite knew what it was saying. If the court hoped somehow to mollify the South with its rulings in Brown 1 and Brown 2, it failed. The decisions were followed by massive Southern resistance. 96 Southern congressmen signed resolutions condemning the Brown decisions. Southern states claimed they were sovereign and could block desegregation orders. Georgia went so far as to announce that it would close any school that attempted to desegregate. In 1957, Eisenhower called out federal troops in Arkansas to try to help enforce desegregation orders that state and local officials were defying. Even so, many Southern schools remained segregated as much as a decade later. The problem of how to integrate American public schools would continue to haunt the court. Part of the challenge was that many American cities were racially segregated by neighborhood, even in many parts of the North, and public schools typically served their local neighborhoods. This meant that even if previously all-white schools technically opened their doors to African-American students, the schools would remain de facto segregated because their neighborhoods contained no African-Americans. One remedy fashioned by some lower courts was busing. By requiring that cities bus some white kids out of some white neighborhoods to black schools and some black kids out of some black neighborhoods to white schools, the courts could achieve some measure of racial integration. These lower court busing orders sometimes made their way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and as you might imagine, the cases were extremely controversial. Here was the dilemma for courts. More than a decade after Brown, many Southern jurisdictions were still relegating many minority children to inferior schools. Many localities were either flagrantly defying court orders or faking compliance. Busing aided the integration process and sent the message that the judiciary would not tolerate such open disrespect of its constitutional rulings. On the other hand, busing was very unpopular, and not just with segregationists. It meant that some children had to spend big chunks of their days on school buses. It also meant that public schools no longer served their immediate communities, thus removing one of the few public institutions that brought neighborhoods together. It also could be expensive and logistically challenging for cities to bus children around from one neighborhood to another, and the money used for busing could be used instead to actually improve schools and to improve the education children of all races received. Many observers also felt that these sorts of policy decisions should be left to local elected officials, not to unelected federal judges, most of whom lacked the requisite policy expertise to oversee such a large bureaucratic task successfully. In fact, it wasn't even clear that the courts had the legal authority to order cities to bus children. It's not unusual in constitutional litigation for a court to issue what's called a negative injunction against a state actor. That requires the state to stop unconstitutional behavior. But issuing a busing order amounted to an affirmative injunction, ordering the state actor to take specific actions designed by a court. Perhaps courts' traditional equitable powers included the authority to do this, but it's hardly clear. Yet another complication was that the Brown decision itself was unclear. Did Brown require desegregation or integration? If it merely required desegregation, then a jurisdiction might be in compliance if it officially opened all its schools to children of all races, even if in practice most of its formerly white schools continue to educate only white children. On this view, courts' primary concern would be whether schools were officially segregated as a matter of law. Alternatively, if Brown required integration, then nominal desegregation would not be enough. That is, the court could have been saying that because of the pernicious history of state-sponsored racism, combined with the persistence of racism throughout our society, more active steps were necessary to bring children of different races together. Unless schools really educated black and white children together, along with children of other races, our public educational system would remain a caste system of haves and have-nots, especially given that many public school systems allocate money on the basis of property taxes, meaning that wealthier, often white neighborhoods would usually have better schools than poorer, often minority school districts. Under this theory, a busing order would help achieve the promise of Brown. Of course, neither the Brown opinion nor the language of the 14th Amendment itself even begin to answer these questions. It therefore shouldn't be too surprising that the Supreme Court justices themselves were deeply divided on the answers. Their busing decisions ended up including a hodgepodge of different views, which made them so confusing and internally contradictory that they sometimes baffled the lower court judges and school officials who were supposed to follow them. One relatively clear rule articulated by the court in a 1974 case called Milliken v. Bradley was that busing had to be done within single school districts. The exceptions were if there were evidence of state-sponsored racial discrimination across school districts that caused racial segregation, or where school district lines had been drawn because of race. But it's hard to find those kinds of smoking guns of racist intent. So the Milliken decision effectively meant that integration through court-ordered school busing programs would be unavailable in many American cities. Incidentally, it's important to note that the Milliken case involved Detroit schools. While the most egregious state-sponsored segregation and racism were in the Deep South, the problem of racially segregated schools occurred in many places, all around the country. Brown v. Board of Education is one of the rare Supreme Court constitutional decisions on an important issue that most Americans today agree is correct. But some scholars contend that Brown failed to deliver what it promised. In a famous book called The Hollow Hope, Professor Gerald Rosenberg argues that people overstate the judiciary's ability to promote social progress. Brown v. Board of Education is his Exhibit 1A. Indeed, many historians agree that real racial progress only began in earnest a decade after Brown, following Congress's passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. One provision of the Civil Rights Act addressed desegregation of schools. Other provisions also helped to protect against racial discrimination in spheres like public accommodations and employment. All criticisms of Brown aside, it's important not to undervalue the decision's contributions too much. In spite of Brown's minimal effects in the first decade after the decision was handed down, it had a significant symbolic effect that laid the groundwork for future advances. Brown sent the message to Americans that racism was harmful and that segregation violated the Constitution. It was largely applauded in the North and may have played a role in helping make civil rights a viable issue in Northern politics. Significantly, Brown may also have been perceived by African Americans as a signal that times were changing and that courts were ready to start protecting their rights. A year after Brown, Rosa Parks refused to yield her seat on a bus to a white person. Her arrest led to bus boycotts. A young preacher named Martin Luther King Jr. spoke out and attracted national attention. Nonviolent demonstrations protesting the horrors of Jim Crow followed for many years in the South. Violent attacks on these civil rights protesters helped turn the rest of the country's attention to the issue, which in turn helped gather political momentum for the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Of course, it's hard to know exactly how much Brown contributed to these events, but the court's decision certainly played some role, as did a series of subsequent very brief Supreme Court rulings, holding that segregated bus systems, beaches, parks, golf courses, and bathhouses were also unconstitutional. Today, Brown is so canonical that a nominee for a federal judgeship would very likely doom his or her candidacy by asserting that Brown was wrong and Plessy was right. In fact, when President Reagan nominated Justice William Rehnquist to the position of Chief Justice in 1986, Rehnquist's views on the decision became a source of trouble for him. Rehnquist had served as a law clerk to Justice Robert Jackson when the court decided Brown, and had written a now infamous memo suggesting that the court follow the rule of Plessy. Rehnquist was ultimately confirmed as Chief Justice, but the national controversy sparked by his 30-year-old memo is a measure of Brown's enduring symbolic power. The history of the court's civil rights decisions reflect a complex relationship between the evolution of equal protection doctrine from Plessy to Brown and beyond, on the one hand, and the evolution of cultural attitudes about race, on the other. Culture and law share a two-way street, and each can influence the other. Brown likely played a role in changing cultural attitudes about race, but changed attitudes also helped shape the court's decision in Brown. Though members of a highly educated elite, Supreme Court justices are still members of society, and they don't decide cases in an intellectual vacuum. It's therefore not surprising that as the country's racial views became more progressive, so too did the court's rulings.
The legal information provided in these lectures is for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing legal advice. You should contact an attorney to obtain advice with respect to any particular legal issue or problem. Lecture 9. The Affirmative Action Conundrum.
Revered though the Supreme Court's 1954 decision on Brown v. Board of Education has become, the court has continued to struggle with questions of race and equal protection. In particular, the court wrestles with affirmative action, that is, with the constitutionality of public institutions giving preferences on the basis of race, usually to racial groups that have been subject to historical discrimination and that remain underrepresented today in institutions of higher education and certain kinds of employment. The constitutionality of affirmative action programs arises regularly, as public employers and universities often adopt racial preferences to try to achieve more diverse workforces and student bodies. The morality and legality of these race-based preferences are deeply contested. On the one hand, most people would agree that affirmative action plans are not racial discrimination in the same sense as segregation and Jim Crow. There's an obvious difference between vicious, invidious segregation and efforts to racially integrate public institutions to overcome the legacy of centuries of discrimination. On the other hand, affirmative action plans do draw distinctions on the basis of race, insofar as they take race into account as part of the criteria for hiring or university admissions. This reliance on race for any purpose offends many people and violates notions of a colorblind constitution. The constitutionality of affirmative action is especially interesting and contested in the context of admissions to selective public universities. The first Supreme Court case addressing these issues was Regents of the University of California v. Bakke in 1978. Out of a class of 100 students, the University of California Davis Medical School set aside 16 slots for certain racial minorities. Applicants from racial minorities were reviewed by a different admissions committee than applicants from other racial groups. A white student denied admission to the medical school sued, asserting that the admissions program violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The issue fractured the Supreme Court badly. The justices wrote 6 different opinions, but none commanded a majority. Justice Lewis Powell wrote the opinion that announced the judgment of the court, and it's Powell's opinion that continues to receive attention to this day. The first question for the court was what level of scrutiny to apply to the university's admissions policies. In the years since Brown, The court has worked out different tiers of scrutiny to apply in different contexts. The tier of scrutiny basically refers to the degree of deference courts will give to the government. Though the court sometimes applies the tiers outside the area of equal protection, it uses the tiers of scrutiny a lot in equal protection cases. The least stringent form of scrutiny, as we've seen already, is rational basis review. When the court reviews a governmental practice under rational basis review, the court will uphold the challenge practice unless it is irrational. This is necessarily a deferential form of review that gives the benefit of the doubt to the government. The basic idea is that political officials, such as state legislators, are democratically elected, and that the court should not substitute its judgment for that of the legislature. The court's default assumption in equal protection cases is that it should apply rational basis review. After all, government must necessarily draw distinctions that treat people differently for a variety of reasons. For example, the law treats murderers differently than non-criminals. If courts stringently reviewed every policy that made distinctions between differently situated people, it would be very difficult for government to operate. However, the court has indicated that some kinds of government classifications are inherently suspect, such as policies classifying people on the basis of race or sex. For example, classifications on the basis of race trigger strict scrutiny, the most rigid form of heightened scrutiny. Under strict scrutiny, the court reviews policies extremely carefully. Whereas the government gets the benefit of the doubt in rational basis cases, it typically does not in strict scrutiny cases. Strict scrutiny involves a two-part test. To pass it, the government must first persuade the court that its policy furthers a compelling governmental interest. In other words, it's not enough that the government interest be legitimate or even important. The governmental interest has to be compelling, essentially very, very important. Second, the government must establish that the policy is necessary to the achievement of that governmental interest. In other words, the government has to demonstrate that it could not achieve the same interest with a different policy that did not raise the same constitutional concerns. An initial question in Bakke was whether the medical school's admissions policy should trigger strict scrutiny or some less stringent form of review. Some observers thought that the court should apply strict scrutiny to affirmative action, as it does for all other governmental policies discriminating on the basis of race. Others thought that affirmative action was sufficiently different from other kinds of racial discrimination that it deserved a less stringent form of scrutiny. In his opinion, Justice Powell announced that strict scrutiny applies for all racial classifications, including affirmative action policies. Four of the other justices, Justices William Brennan, Byron White, Thurgood Marshall, and Harry Blackmun, would have applied intermediate scrutiny, which, as the name suggests, falls somewhere between strict scrutiny and rational basis. These justices pointed out that Mr. Bakke was white. Whites as a class, they argued, have not been subject to historical discrimination. So a policy burdening as a class should not necessarily be viewed the same way as a policy that discriminated against a group like African Americans who have been subject to deep and historic discrimination. The other justices, however, saw the matter differently. Whereas Justice Brennan and others wanted the court to distinguish between benign and invidious racial discrimination, Justice Powell pointed out that it may not always be clear that a so-called preference is in fact benign. Indeed, even well-intentioned race-based preferences may have the pernicious effect of reinforcing common stereotypes that certain groups are unable to achieve success without special protections. For these reasons, Justice Powell concluded that racial and ethnic distinctions of any sort are inherently suspect, and thus call for the most exacting judicial examination. The guarantee of equal protection, Powell explained, applies to all persons. Having decided that affirmative action programs triggered strict scrutiny, Justice Powell found that the UC Davis admissions policy failed the test. To reach this conclusion, he first reviewed the state's purported interests behind the affirmative action policy. One potential state interest cited by the university was in improving the delivery of healthcare to underserved communities. Justice Powell rejected this argument because there was no evidence in the record indicating that the medical school's affirmative action program actually promoted that goal. The university could not assure, for example, that racial minorities admitted under the affirmative action plan would actually serve disadvantaged communities as doctors after graduation. Another asserted interest was in eliminating or at least ameliorating the harmful effects of discrimination. To the extent that African Americans and other racial minorities have been subject to widespread and longstanding discrimination, affirmative action programs are one small way of trying to lessen those harms. Justice Powell rejected that interest in this context. He explained that the court has never approved a classification that aids persons perceived as members of relatively victimized groups at the expense of other innocent individuals in the absence of governmental findings of constitutional or statutory violations. He goes on to explain that without careful oversight to minimize harm to innocent people, the government may not implement policies that help members of a victimized group by harming people like Mr. Bakke, who presumably had not himself committed abuses that hurt racial minorities. Justice Powell also makes a related point here about institutional legitimacy. The UC Davis Medical School had adopted an important policy about a matter of great public concern without guidance from elected officials, such as the California legislature. As Powell put it, isolated segments of our vast governmental structures are not competent to make those decisions implicating constitutional rights, at least in the absence of legislative mandates and legislatively determined criteria. This is an issue that I've explored in some of my own scholarship, and it's a crucial one in the United States today, given how much governmental policy is determined by administrative agencies at both the federal and state level. To the extent that agencies, like public universities, sometimes set policies that implicate individual constitutional rights, what level of deference do courts owe those policies? Should courts review administrative regulations the same way they review statutes adopted by elected legislatures? Interestingly, the Supreme Court rarely addresses this question, though it arises all the time. So Justice Powell rejected many of the state's asserted interests, but there was one more interest to consider: the university's interest in having a diverse student body. Justice Powell was more sympathetic to this interest, which he deemed clearly to be constitutionally permissible. A university, he indicated, should have the academic freedom to make its own judgments about the selection of its student body. Moreover, doctors serve a diverse population, so it makes sense that medical schools would want a diverse student body in which students could share perspectives and ideas with one another and go on to use their expanded outlooks for the benefit of the public at large. The state's interest in a diverse student body satisfied the first part of the strict scrutiny test, that the state had a compelling governmental interest. But recall that strict scrutiny also requires that the policy in question be necessary to the achievement of that interest. And here the policy failed. In particular, Justice Powell objected to the particular design of the policy, which seemed like a quota program. UC Davis set aside a specified number of seats in each class for individuals from preferred ethnic groups. To help explain why Davis's quota system was not necessary to achieve racial diversity, Justice Powell contrasted it with Harvard College's admissions program. Harvard also had an affirmative action policy. However, unlike the UC Davis Medical School, Harvard did not specify the number of racial minorities the college needed to admit. Instead, when the Harvard Admissions Committee reviewed the large middle group of admissible applicants who were capable of doing good coursework, an applicant's race might tip the balance in the admissions decision, just as other criteria such as geographic origin could. In other words, race was sometimes a plus factor in Harvard admission decisions, helping a racial minority candidate who had already been deemed admissible. But race was not the only factor, and race did not insulate any applicant from comparison with all other candidates for available admission slots. Phrased simply, whereas the Harvard plan treated each applicant as an individual, considering an applicant's entire package, including her race, the Davis plan did not. Justice Powell's opinion in Bakke was the court's most important statement on affirmative action in higher education for over a generation. The next time the court confronted that issue was in 2003, when it decided two separate cases about different affirmative action programs at the University of Michigan. The case Grutter v. Bollinger addressed the University of Michigan Law School's admissions policy. The companion case, Gratz v. Bollinger, involved the admissions policy of the University of Michigan College of Literature, Science, and the Arts. The court ended up upholding the law school's affirmative action program and striking down the colleges. In so doing, the court, following Justice Powell's opinion in Bakke, indicated that affirmative action programs can be constitutional, but only if they're carefully designed. Let's start by looking at the law school's affirmative action policy at issue in the Grutter case. The Michigan Law School's admission policy bore some strong resemblance to the Harvard plan that Justice Powell had praised in Bakke. Specifically, the plan was not a quota system that targeted a particular number of racial minorities to admit. Rather, the law school looked at each applicant's entire file and considered racial diversity as a plus factor that would aid an applicant's admissions chances. The school aimed for a critical mass of racial minority groups so that class members from that group would not feel isolated. But unlike the UC Davis Medical School's program in Bakke, the law school did not have a predetermined number of slots for racial minorities. In determining whether this policy violated the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, the court started once again with the level of scrutiny. Like Justice Powell and Bakke, the court announced that affirmative action triggers strict scrutiny, just like other kinds of racial discrimination. The state thus needed to show that the policy was necessary to achieving a compelling governmental interest. The Grutter court found, as Justice Powell had found in Bakke, that student body diversity is a compelling state interest. Interestingly, in reaching this conclusion, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, writing for the majority, deferred to the law school's educational judgment. On the one hand, this reasoning makes sense. An educational institution, like a law school, is going to understand better than a bunch of federal judges why racial diversity is important to its educational mission. Improved racial diversity can help achieve cross-racial understanding. It can help break down racial stereotypes and enable students to better understand persons from different backgrounds and different races. These lessons can be invaluable for all students. On the other hand, this deference is curious because the court already announced it was applying strict scrutiny. Strict scrutiny is usually not supposed to be deferential. If a court simply accepts that an asserted governmental interest is compelling because the government says it is, then this part of the strict scrutiny test doesn't seem too strict. Having determined that the law school's policy furthered a compelling interest, the court went on to analyze it under the second prong of the strict scrutiny test, asking whether the policy was necessary to the achievement of that interest. Or as the court sometimes puts it, instead, was it specifically and narrowly framed? Citing Justice Powell and Bakke, the court praised the law school for its individualized application process that considered race in a flexible, non-mechanical way. The court found such individualized review constitutionally acceptable because it helped ensure that race or ethnicity was not the defining feature of any given application. This analysis makes sense on its own terms, but note that the court did not require the exhaustion of every conceivable race-neutral alternative. Here, too, then, the court seemed to be watering down strict scrutiny. Perhaps the court was right to do this in this context, but if so, then why purport to apply strict scrutiny at all? One lesson here is that the tiers of scrutiny may be more like points along a spectrum rather than discrete categories. Thus, the court's approach to strict scrutiny in affirmative action cases may not be quite as strict as in other cases involving invidious racial discrimination. Another lesson is that sometimes we have to pay attention not just to what the court says, but to what it does. In Grutter, the court said it was applying strict scrutiny and treating affirmative action the same as all racial discrimination. However, that does not seem to be what the court actually did. Justice O'Connor closed with a noteworthy point. The Grutter case, she observed, was decided 25 years after Bakke. In those years, the number of minority applicants with high grades and test scores had increased. Given those improvements, Justice O'Connor opined that in 25 more years, racial preferences may no longer be necessary at all to achieve diversity in higher education. This unusual statement seemed to reflect the fact that some justices are uncomfortable with affirmative action, but that until greater racial diversity can be attained in higher education without it, they're inclined not to strike it down. This approach might be explained in part by Justice Ginsburg's observation in a concurrence that racism, both conscious and unconscious, persists in our society, and that the inequities of the past and present may make it hard or impossible to achieve significant diversity without racial preferences. In total, four justices joined Justice O'Connor's majority, upholding the law school's admissions plan by a narrow 5-4 vote. Justice Thomas's dissent is particularly worthy of discussion. As of this filming, Justice Thomas is only the second African-American to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. And for his entire tenure on the court, he has been the court's lone black member. He is a staunch opponent of affirmative action. Justice Thomas argued that racial minorities can and have achieved in the U.S. without affirmative action. As an example, he noted that California barred affirmative action in that state, and minority enrollment at the prestigious UC Berkeley Law School had actually increased since then. Justice Thomas continued that affirmative action is not only unnecessary, but is also harmful. Affirmative action programs, he argued, stamp racial minorities with a badge of inferiority because other students sometimes see minorities as undeserving. Affirmative action, thus, results in a stigma that causes serious harm to the very people it's supposed to help. The Constitution, in Justice Thomas's view, then, does not permit any classifications on the basis of race. They demean us all. Justice Thomas was on the losing end of the Grutter case, but not on the other Michigan affirmative action case. In that one, Gratz v. Bollinger, the justices voted 6-3 to strike down the college's admissions program. The college's program differed in some important respects from the law school's. The college relied on a point system. To gain admission, an applicant needed to receive 100 points total. Applicants received various number of points for different accomplishments. Racial minorities from particular groups automatically received 20 points. By contrast, residents of Michigan received 10 points and children of alumni received 4 points. In the eyes of the court, this plan was not individualized enough to withstand constitutional scrutiny. Whereas the law school's plan had required that each applicant be considered as an individual, the college's was more mechanical, simply adding up the points. Moreover, the court seemed to think that the college afforded too much weight to race. For example, while applicants received 20 points for racial minority status, they only received 5 points for being a talented artist. Notice the breakdown of the justices in these two cases. 3 justices would have upheld both programs, Justices Stevens, Souter, and Ginsburg. 4 would have struck them both down, Chief Justice Rehnquist, and Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas. Only 2 justices, Justices O'Connor and Breyer, thought that the differences between the programs merited a different outcome. But it was the view of those 2 that tipped the balance in each case. In ruling on the Michigan cases, then, the court ended up rejecting more extreme positions that would have upheld or invalidated both programs, instead agreeing upon a middle ground. An advantage of this middle ground approach is that it perhaps signals to the country that the court understands these are difficult, contentious issues with powerful arguments on both sides. The disadvantage, though, is that it requires a detailed factual inquiry into each affirmative action plan to decide whether it's constitutional. As a result, the law remains murky for universities, lawyers, and lower courts as they struggle to apply the court's decisions to new admissions plans. The issue of affirmative action returned to the court after Grutter and Gratz, but the results didn't provide us with a lot of helpful additional guidance. The case Fisher v. University of Texas involved the admissions program at the University of Texas in Austin. The University of Texas initially adopted a plan under which in-state students in the top 10% of their high school class automatically gain admission to the University of Texas at Austin. After the Grutter decision upheld affirmative action, however, the University of Texas decided it wanted to try to add more diversity than it was getting through the 10% plan. So it retained the 10% plan and admitted roughly 3/4 of its incoming students through that plan. But for the remaining slots, the university adopted an affirmative action plan similar to the one the Supreme Court had upheld in the Grutter case. Under this plan, the university gave preferential treatment to certain racial minorities, but it considered each application separately, so that race was one of many factors considered. Texas argued that that approach helped it achieve more diversity in specific programs and classes. Abigail Fisher was a white student who applied for admission to the University of Texas. She was not in the top 10% of her high school class, so she sought to gain entrance for those other slots through the university's holistic full-file review. She was denied admission, and she sued, alleging that the university's consideration of race disadvantaged her and other Caucasian students. Fisher's case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court on two separate occasions. In 2013, the court sent the case back down to the lower courts with instructions to make sure that strict scrutiny was applied more strictly. In this first opinion following Grutter and following Justice Powell's Bakke opinion, the court, per Justice Kennedy, accepted the university's argument that diversity was a compelling governmental interest. But on the second half of the strict scrutiny test, whether the means chosen by the university to attain diversity are narrowly tailored to that goal, the Supreme Court faulted the lower court for deferring to the university's insistence that the policy was narrowly tailored. Narrow tailoring, Justice Kennedy explained, requires the reviewing court to verify that the policy in question is necessary to achieve the interest at issue, in this case, diversity. On this point, the court should not just take the government's word for it. The court therefore sent the case back to the lower court with instructions to apply the correct standard. But in due time, the case returned again to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 2016, the court decided it. This time around, the court, by a 4-3 vote, upheld the university's admissions plan. Only 7 justices participated in the case. Justice Antonin Scalia had recently died, and Justice Elena Kagan recused herself because she had worked on the case while she was serving as Solicitor General of the United States prior to her appointment on the court. In this iteration of the case, known as Fisher II, the court once again accepted that diversity was a compelling interest. And on the narrow tailoring prong, the court accepted that the admissions program was narrowly tailored. It found that UT had closely studied the problem of achieving racial diversity and decided that a race-neutral approach wasn't working. Some minority students who were at the university experienced loneliness and isolation, and over half of the undergraduate classes with 5 or more students had no African-American students in it. By considering race as a factor, the university was able to bolster the number of racial minorities attending the university. In other words, The court seemed to say that the university had tried to achieve its objective without considering race, and that that hadn't worked well enough. So it should be permitted to try a policy that does permit the consideration of race. Moreover, the majority pointed out universities should enjoy flexibility to decide which students to admit. Colleges don't just pick the students with the highest test scores. They can and should consider a variety of factors to put together an interesting, diverse, multi-talented class. As the court put it, a university is in large part defined by those intangible qualities which are incapable of objective measurement, but which make for greatness. In dissent, Justice Samuel Alito argued that the university failed to articulate with any clarity what benefits it hoped to achieve from greater diversity. For example, what viewpoints of African Americans and Latino students are missing from the students who already get admitted into the university under the 10% plan? What, Justice Alito asked, is wrong with the racial minorities admitted to the university under that plan? Furthermore, Justice Alito pointed out that while the policy aided certain racial minorities, it hurt others. Asians, for example, were generally disadvantaged by the policy because UT considered them overrepresented based on state demographics. Additionally, Justice Alito contended that race actually played a bigger role in admissions than the university claimed. The university stated that race is just one of many factors in a holistic review of each student. However, race was the only one of the university's holistic factors that it placed on the cover of every application to be reviewed, thus presumably making reviewers constantly aware of an applicant's race. As Justice Alito put it, consideration of race pervades every aspect of UT's admissions process. The Fisher II case signaled that affirmative action plans that are carefully designed to review each individual applicant holistically are constitutional, at least for the time being. But affirmative action is one of those issues on which a change in the court's membership could tilt the outcome in the other direction. In the meantime, the court has signaled that universities like UT should constantly reassess how they achieve diversity by engaging in constant deliberation and continued reflection regarding its admissions policies. One of the difficult things about affirmative action is that, as with many constitutional issues, there are persuasive arguments on both sides of the debate. There's much to be said for Justice O'Connor's view that diversity in education helps people better understand the experiences of other groups, which in turn helps them provide more value to their future workplaces. And yet Justice Thomas also has a powerful point that affirmative action can stigmatize and harm the very people it seeks to benefit, and that many racial minorities have succeeded in this country without it. Notice that the justices' different views of affirmative action reflect not only different interpretations of the 14th Amendment, but also different visions of Brown v. Board of Education. To some justices, Brown promised colorblindness. Affirmative action offends this principle because the government is using race as a factor when sorting people when it makes admissions decisions. To other justices, Brown forbids a caste system under which the government treats some people as second-class citizens. Along these lines, affirmative action programs, which try to bring people of different races together, are entirely different from racial segregation, which sought to keep them apart. As Justice Stevens once put it, the colorblind vision disregards the difference between a no trespassing sign and a welcome mat. Regardless of where each of us comes down in these issues, it's important to honestly wrestle with the arguments on both sides. We don't necessarily need to change our minds upon listening to the other side's views, but we should try to understand where they come from. Even if we ultimately reject them, listening can help us all understand the issues and each other better.
The legal information provided in these lectures is for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing legal advice. You should contact an attorney to obtain advice with respect to any particular legal issue or problem. Lecture 10, sex discrimination, and women's rights.
The U.S. Constitution is the only major Western constitution that does not include a provision explicitly declaring that the sexes have equal rights under the law. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, you will recall, says nothing about sex discrimination. This is no historical accident. There seems little doubt that sex discrimination was not foremost on the minds of the men who wrote and ratified the 14th Amendment and its Equal Protection Clause. As we've seen, their primary concern was protecting the newly freed slaves from discrimination in the South in the aftermath of the Civil War. Also, of course, women were second-class citizens of the United States and most other countries at the time. That's not to say that some women weren't pushing hard to change their status in society. In fact, women's suffrage groups, which had joined abolitionists in fighting for the downfall of slavery, had tried to add the right to vote for women into the Constitution, but the 14th Amendment's text plainly makes no mention of that right. Indeed, the amendment was long interpreted to have no applicability to the topic of sex discrimination. Take, for example, the 19th century case of Myra Bradwell. Bradwell sought a license to practice law, and the Illinois Supreme Court denied it on the sole ground that she was a woman. It wasn't disputed that she was otherwise qualified. Bradwell's case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1873, where in Bradwell v. Illinois, all but one justice voted against her. Interestingly, the justices did not even consider the applicability of the Equal Protection Clause, focusing instead on the question of whether the right to practice in the courts of a state was a privilege or immunity of U.S. citizenship protected under the 14th Amendment. They held that it was not. In a concurring opinion, Justice Joseph Bradley highlighted his era's views about the inherent differences between the sexes. The civil law, wrote Bradley, as well as nature herself, has always recognized a wide difference in the respective spheres and destinies of man and woman. Man is, or should be, woman's protector and defender. The natural and proper timidity and delicacy which belongs to the female sex evidently unfits it for many of the occupations of civil life. The constitution of the family organization, which is founded in the divine ordinance as well as in the nature of things, indicates the domestic sphere as that which properly belongs to the domain and functions of womanhood. Bradwell v. Illinois was hardly anomalous for the times. The next year, 1874, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously in Minor v. Happersett, that women have no constitutional right to vote. The court conceded that women, like men, can be citizens of the United States. Accordingly, if the right to vote were a privilege or immunity of U.S. citizenship, then the denial of women's suffrage would violate the Constitution. The court, however, concluded that suffrage was not a privilege or immunity of U.S. citizenship. Accordingly, states could constitutionally decide to deny women the franchise. After failing in the courts, the women's movement sought the franchise through constitutional amendment. This effort took decades, but in 1920, the court's decision in Minor v. Happersett was superseded by the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which reads that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The franchise was a significant victory for the women's rights movement, but it did not by any means provide women with overnight genuine equality, either in U.S. culture or in the courts. As late as 1961 in Hoyt v. Florida, the court upheld a Florida law that included women on jury lists only if they registered a desire to be included with the clerk of the court. Over 40 years after women obtained the right to vote, the court explained that woman is still regarded as the center of home and family life. In the early 1970s, both houses of Congress proposed an equal rights amendment that would have added explicit protection against sex discrimination. The language read, Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The proposed amendment also empowered Congress to pass legislation further protecting against such constitutional violations. Under Article 5 of the Constitution, a proposed constitutional amendment must be ratified by 3/4 of the states to take legal effect. Within a few months of Congress's submission of the Equal Rights Amendment to the states in 1972, roughly half the required states had ratified it. Ratification slowed down afterwards, however, and even though Congress extended the time period for ratification until June 30, 1982, the effort fell just short. Under the Constitution, 38 states were needed to ratify the amendment, but as of the deadline, only 35 had done so. The Equal Rights Amendment had failed. In spite of the slow pace of change in laws affecting the rights of women, the underlying social movement for women's rights continued to advance. Social attitudes towards sex equality changed dramatically in the final decades of the 20th century, and eventually, so did the Supreme Court's approach to questions of sex discrimination. An important doctrinal question in these cases was what level of scrutiny to apply where governmental sex discrimination is alleged. As we've previously seen, the court typically applies what's called rational basis review to most governmental classifications when they're challenged. This means that government need only have a rational reason for implementing the policy in question for the court to uphold the policy. At the other end of the spectrum, we've also seen that courts apply strict scrutiny to classifications on the basis of race. This tier reflects the court's judgment that governmental classifications on the basis of race are strongly disfavored usually. But what to do about classifications on the basis of sex? Should they be treated more like classifications on the basis of race, or more like many other classifications, which, for better or worse, court tends to give government benefit of the doubt on? There are arguments on each side of the ledger. Like many racial minorities, women have suffered a long history of discrimination in our country. Though times have improved, contemporary stereotypes about the differences between the sexes linger and affect women's professional opportunities. Also, like racial minorities, women tend to be underrepresented in positions of political and business power. Moreover, sex, like race, tends to be an immediately visible characteristic that makes unfair discrimination all too easy. Additionally, sex, like race, historically has been immutable, still another reason courts sometimes offer for extending heightened judicial protection to certain groups. To be sure, medical developments have now made sex changes possible, but it's still difficult to change sexes. On the other hand, there are reasons to think that sex is quite different from race as a constitutional matter. For one, there are indisputable biological differences between men and women that at least arguably justify treating men and women differently in some circumstances. Most obviously, women can bear children while men cannot. Moreover, while the court has sometimes indicated that it is more willing to offer added judicial protections to minority groups that might not be able to protect themselves through the normal political processes, women aren't a minority. Indeed, women actually make up a slight majority of the population, and they now have the right to vote. It therefore seems odd that they should need extrajudicial protection in the way that certain racial minorities might. Although the court historically approached sex discrimination cases with great deference to the government, by the early 1970s, litigants were calling for the court to deem sex a suspect classification that, like race, triggered heightened scrutiny. Initially, the court refused to do so, instead continuing to apply the rational basis review that it traditionally had. Sometimes, however, it's important to look not just at what the court had said, but at what it has done. And there are good reasons to think that the court's application of rational basis review became less deferential in sex discrimination cases during this period. Take, for example, the court's 1971 decision in Reed v. Reed, which cited the Equal Protection Clause in invalidating an Idaho law preferring men over women as estate administrators. The Idaho law ranked categories of people who were entitled to administer the estate of someone who had died based on their relationship to the deceased.